Welcome to Edge of Sports, the podcast, only brought to you by The Nation Magazine, the best weekly political mag on this earth. Subscribe to it, read it, and enjoy it. Critical thinking for a critical time. Today, we are going back to our basketball butterfly effect series with Arya Shirazi. And, ooh, boy, do we have a butterfly effect to speak to you about today. Let me set it up, and then I'll introduce Arya to make it all plain. Okay, look, we all know that today's NBA is dominated by players not only not born in the United States, but also who never went through the U.S. high school or college systems. I mean, just think of who are the indisputably best players in the NBA. They have names like Nikola Jokic, Luka Doncic, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Thanasis Antetokounmpo, no, just kidding with that last one. But also, you have to say, even though he's been hurt, Joel Embiid, who, yes, did go to Kansas for 1 year, but for the purposes of this discussion, we're counting him on our list of people who did not go through the U.S. system and yet are absolutely the top of the pyramid in today's NBA. And frankly, has made it a much better, more exciting and amazing sport. The question that we're going to ask, though, is how did we get here with this amazing talent born outside the U.S. pipeline? And Arya and I are going to argue that two pivot points caused this change, and I'm going to get Arya to elucidate on this. The first was the one that pretty much everyone says when they speak of the globalization of talent, which is, you know, the 92 Dream Team going with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the USSR, which revealed to a richer degree how much talent was out there. We know that. But there's another pivot as well, which frankly, a lot of our history could be different without this. The shockingly bad bronze medal performance of the 1988 U.S. Olympic team, the last year we sent amateur players and were totally outclassed. That opened the door for the pros, the dream team, yada, yada, yada. And Arya knows his 1988 U.S. Olympic team, so I'm excited to get that topic into his transom. But we're going to discuss that it was from these events that you get the first generation of players who changed the NBA. Not Jokic and Doncic, but some other guys that we're going to tip our hat to as well. And we're going to get to them. But first, Arya, great to see you, my man.
Great to be here, Dave. Thanks for having me back.
So before we jump in to me, like one of the pivot points that changed everything, which was the 1988 U.S. Olympic team, any thoughts on the introduction? I always like asking you that first. Anything in the way I set it up, anything you want to add, subtract, edit me live, baby.
I would never think to subtract from any of your introductory comments, Dave. No, I think that you set it up pretty much exactly right. I think for not only today's young fan, but the last few generations of NBA fans, it's almost impossible to imagine an NBA not littered with players from all across the globe. It has been at least two decades now that NBA teams are represented by multiple international players, stars, all-stars, role players, end-of-the-bench projects, two-way G-leaguers. As we said, the NBA is truly what it always was, which is the absolute top of the world basketball food chain. And pretty much player, you know, the game is being played in all corners of the world. And the top players and top prospects from every continent now have as the ultimate goal making it to and succeeding in the NBA. That has been the reality of the league for quite a while now. As you said, and I agree with, it has made the quality of the league and the league's play, it has improved it. The fact that truly the best players in the world are represented under one league and as competition for one another. But right, the NBA that you and I started watching and really fell in love with the league watching was the exact opposite. It was American players and all following that traditional route, that familiar route, going through the United States college system. And in most cases, staying for 3, if not 4 years. So as we've said on past episodes, we really got to know the best players in college basketball over a 3-year span, the course of their careers before they came into the NBA. We were familiar with them as players. So as you said, it is, you know, what was it that or what series of events turned that tide, changed the reality, ushering in the game that we have today, truly global.
It's crazy how different it is. I'm blanking on the player's name. He was like one of the first to come over. Glauchev, he was on the Suns.
Yorgi Glauchkov from Bulgaria.
Yorgi, very good. Say his name one more time for me.
I believe it's Yorgi Glauchkov.
Yorgi Glauchkov. I remember reading an article in Sports Illustrated about Yorgi Glauchkov. And the sentiment of the writer was that long term, are you really going to see this on other teams? The dude can't even speak English. And so it really was like, you know, he was basically saying, wow, yeah, these players from Eastern Europe or from overseas, you know, they're like disco in 1980, baby, a stock that's going to go straight down. And to be so spectacularly wrong and to base your entire opinion on Yorgi Glauchkov is really something. So yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, we don't often take a step back and think about what a bold new world this is, and the way they've been able to make it work with different languages, different cultures. Mm-hmm. Like, it always just feels seamless because basketball, I'm sorry, but it brings people in concert with one another.
Absolutely. No, and as you were saying, in the 80s, there were a few players of much higher quality than Glauchkov, all-star caliber or even absolute superstars who we knew were born outside the U.S. Hakeem Olajuwon was Nigerian. Detlef Schrempf was from West Germany. And even Patrick Ewing was from Jamaica, even though he played his high school ball in Boston. You know, and occasionally in post-game interviews, Patrick would let his accent come out every so often. And that was always kind of cool as a little reminder. But even those players went through not only the familiar path, but seemingly the only path to go to the NBA. The days of Daryl Dawkins and Moses Malone coming right from high school was a relic at that point. Nobody was doing that, and it would be a decade or so until Kevin Garnett became the trendsetter, bringing that back for about a 10-year period. But Olajuwon and Schrempf, Ewing, they went through U.S. colleges. They played at the biggest U.S. colleges in the biggest conferences. Olajuwon and Ewing famously played for the national championship in 1984, were back-to-back number one picks. So there was a precedent for non-US born players to excel in the NBA, but it was nothing like what was to happen at the end of that decade.
Not at all. One of the pivots that started to change things, of course, was when we start sending our pros overseas and they actually get to play against that first generation of players who grew up outside the system. And one of the things that we're arguing here is that that very important piece of the puzzle maybe doesn't happen without the spectacular collapse of the 1988 Olympic team, and which was augured, let's remember, by 1987, at the Pan Am Games, Oscar Schmidt leading Brazil to a gold medal over the US when he scored 46 points. I remember watching that game, and afterwards the commentators were like, "This is an aberration. It took a one-time Superman performance. We're going to dominate at the 88 Olympics." That was the conventional wisdom, that Oscar Schmidt had just been blessed by the basketball gods for one night, and maybe he was. But it also, this is a team game, and Brazil outplayed the United States, which, in retrospect, really augured something to come. So, Aria, before we talk about what happened with this 88 Olympic team, who were they? Who was coaching? Who was on the squad? And is this an impressive team to you relative to the rest of the country? And was this inevitable, or did John Thompson just really do a poor job picking a team? Those are all my questions.
Well, the in 1988, really the only way that one could become familiarized with stars outside of this country was in international competition, and that really meant the Olympics. And you had talked about Oscar Schmidt. I think maybe off of that high scoring Pan American Games performance, Oscar in Brazil, because of his performances against the US in international competition, he was one of those players that we heard of. We knew of Oscar. We knew of Sabonis, Russian guy playing in Europe. We knew of Sabonis as possibly the best center in the world. Wouldn't it be great to see him going up against Olajuwon to see who truly was the best center in the world? We talked a couple of episodes ago about Brad Daugherty and Brad's reputation for a good long time as the best passing center in the NBA. The big man who was considered a better passer than Brad Daugherty at the time was Sabonis. He had a huge reputation. And the fact that you only could occasionally catch a glimpse of these players just kind of added to their legend, or certainly added to their mystique. And they were really, it was really a sense of what if. And, because you didn't know if it was a rare performance in international competition, or if these great performances by these non-American, non-NBA players, if they really were as good as the players that we recognized as the absolute best, and really never had any reason to question that, really didn't have much of a sense of high quality basketball being played outside of the NBA, except for when you saw performers like this in the Olympics. Schmidt and Sabonis are kind of the most notable. Of course, Oscar never comes over. Sabonis comes over once he's past his physical prime. And is still a very impactful player, but it's a bittersweet tenure for Arvidas in the NBA because we knew that we were seeing a limited version of what he had been. But in 1988, as you said, I'm familiar with that Olympic team coached by John Thompson. And being a huge Syracuse fan, right off the bat, I was a little antagonized that Thompson was the Olympic coach. It was incredibly deserved, But the fact that the head honcho at Georgetown was getting the nod was a little bit annoying. And when you look at the team now, yeah, there's a lot of good players, a lot of good 20 and 21 year old college players. At the time, I didn't think that Thompson had picked the best team. I thought that a combination of overemphasis on defense and a little bit of program nepotism influenced his decisions. And a few of my favorite college players, who I thought were deserved, didn't wind up on the team. But it's actually a very strong team of amateurs led by still serving out his naval obligation, David Robinson, College Player of the Year, Danny Manning, Mitch Richmond, Percy Hawkins, Dan Marley, all of who would go on to all-star NBA careers and were spectacular college players, and two Charles Smiths, All-American big man from Pittsburgh who would go on to Knicks layup infamy, and Thompson's own point guard, also named Charles Smith. So you had said, I think you've said on two different occasions so far, spectacular failure or something along those lines.
Oh, before you go on, just because I looked it up while you're talking, like some, you named the big names on this team, but just to round it out, because it's just some great, those guys.
Jeff Greer,
yep. J.R. Reed.
Carolina.
Somebody you mentioned to me just yesterday, so you should get it. And I'll just name the two others while you think who that is. Willie Anderson and Bimbo Coles, which shocked me to see.
You see, that's what I'm saying. I mean, I don't
you
know.
You mentioned yesterday.
Well, Augman, of course.
Stacey Augman, yes.
Stacey Augman. And Plastic Man sticks out in my mind because he was coming off a freshman year at UNLV. And I remember being very unhappy that neither Chris Morris or Sean Elliott, who were two college forwards that I loved, were snubbed, as well as no Syracuse players, which I found to be a giant conspiracy, Hoya conspiracy. But Augman...
Kurt Coleman?
Yeah, or Sherman, come on now. The general? Augman was the player who, to me, was kind of indicative of Thompson's roster decision making, an all defensive guy who put almost all his energy on that end. Very Thompson, but I didn't find him or a few of those guys to be the most deserving players. As I said, you have described it as a spectacular failure. And with the amateur dominance that the United States had always enjoyed, it looked like that. But that U.S. team wound up with the bronze. And I think that is where that team should have wound up in the 88 Olympics. And I know that it was that third place finish, and particularly the two countries were that finished ahead in the gold and silver, that really clinched the decision of the U.S. Olympic Committee to go to professionals for the 92 Olympics. But it made sense to me then, and particularly now, that the gold and silver would go to the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia. And of course, we are at a pivotal, fascinating point in time for both of those countries, entities, and what was to happen very shortly within the next year, and on a much, much smaller scale, how it affected basketball, international basketball. But that United States team, even with a buff 22-year-old David Robinson in the middle, we're playing against Soviet and Yugoslav professionals.
Men.
And truly men.
Men.
And so many of those players would, of course, go on to kind of be the pioneers of the new reality of international players coming into and succeeding in the NBA. But I think that the reaction should have been less of panic, because if Thompson's Olympic team had won gold, I think it would have been a huge upset, or a brilliant job of coaching, because again, it was taking college All-Americans going up against the best pros, adults, in what was soon to become several countries. And and several very strong basketball nations, at the time consolidated into two. So that U.S. Olympic team should have finished third where they did. But it, of course, led to, on the American side.
You know, it's not only American hubris looking back, because you ask yourself the question, or I'm asking myself the question, why were we so convinced we'd win this Olympics when we were sending children against grown men with, you know, it's just ridiculous that.
Well, because this country always had under those same circumstances.
Yes.
That's why.
Yes. But also it speaks to how bad and different international scouting was back then. We really had no idea who the hell we were playing. I mean, maybe Sabonis was a known it, but not really. There wasn't real scouting of these guys. We knew the stars, but that's it. And man, a tip of the hat to Arvydas Sabonis as we talk about this, though. You know, the father, of course, of Domantas. Domantas? I always get that wrong. It's Domantas.
I think you got it right.
Yeah, and his 197 straight double-doubles and the whole thing. I mean, if people don't know it, Arvydas was so ahead of his time, so brilliant. He becomes a rookie in the NBA at age 31. So he plays in the NBA between age 31 till he's 38. And so we got an Arvydas Sabonis with incredible smarts. You know, I'm looking at his stats. I mean, do you know how much he averaged like his rookie year?
12 a game?
14 and a half. And he came in second in the Rookie of the Year voting. That's wild to me.
Yeah, and, even in his...
Is he the first stretch five?
Do you count Lane Beer?
I don't count him for much. Bill Lane Beer, as Peter Vesey called him, Bill Stale Ale. So good. Yeah, no, so just a tip of the hat to Sabonis. I mean, we saw the last of him, but, you know, the Sabonis who was at that 88 Olympics was, you know, leaping over David Robinson. It would have been so amazing to have him in the NBA. But, yeah, that 88 team, good players. Mitch Richmond, Hersey Hawkins, Dan Majerle. I remember people being shocked that Majerle was chosen coming out of, I believe it was Central Michigan. Is that right? Yeah, and that was like a shocker to people. And then, yeah, leaving Sean Elliott off was, and Danny Ferry was a shocker to people too. But I think what we're saying is that it really doesn't matter what team that we were going to put out there. Like we were destined to lose, and the dream team was going to come at some point because the marketing opportunities were just too lucrative. It just took a loss to get the American public behind the idea. Like, I think we liked the idea of winning with our amateurs forever and laughing in the face of our East European brethren, divided by a wall of iron. Curtain. But what I want to talk about is that first generation of players then who came, because I want folks to know like who really did lay that initial groundwork, how successful they were, what stereotypes they faced, and how they were able to conquer those stereotypes. Can I throw the proverbial ball for you to start that off? I know one of these guys is an all-time Shirazi player, so.
Okay, yeah, pardon me, absolutely. Even just in thinking about, as you had said, it seemed almost as though in 88, the United States was unprepared for the quality of opposition that they would be facing. It was a rude awakening that shouldn't have been so rude. But really, a lot had changed, apparently, in basketball outside the US since 1976. And I say that because 1976 was the last time before 88 that the full squadron of countries who played competitive basketball competed. In 1980, the US boycotted the Moscow Olympics. In 1984, the Soviet Union boycotted the Los Angeles Olympics. So 12 years had passed since at least the Soviets and the Americans were playing each other, and the Soviet athletic and basketball program and the Yugoslav athletic and basketball program had undergone major improvements and major national emphasis in that period. So I think you're correct when you say, in a way, the US was unprepared because the professionals that their amateurs had been beating in the 70s and before hadn't been up to the quality that they then were facing in 88 and would have faced for 8 years earlier. So I think that is kind of a bit, and I had always loved at least the two Olympic teams that I had been aware of before the Dream Team in 84 and 88. I love the fact that the Olympic teams were composed of college players.
Yeah,
I just
sure.
really liked that. I knew a lot of the college players, so I thought that was really cool. Just from a, I don't know, either a competitive or it was just, the NBA guys, they get to do everything, but this is the college players. And of course, it was not winning the gold in 88 that really brought to the public consciousness the fact that the US was sending amateurs and everybody else was sending professionals. So although I kind of lamented the end of the college players making up the US Olympic team, it was the right time and it was the right move. And I don't say that because so that the US could get the gold back, because I'm not that kind of dude. I never cared if the US won Olympic medals in a basketball or any other sport. But I mean, it actually, if all countries are sending their pros, then this country should send its pros as well. And then it did. And it went back to winning gold. So, but it is the, and I'm going to look to you to put and to give any more historical context that you think is necessary, if you think any further context is necessary, as to the fall of the Soviet Union, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the dissolving of Yugoslavia, is, of course, players that we, particularly from the 1988 Olympics, players that we were now very familiar with. And it is really, it is the changes in those countries and the players of those countries who come to the NBA as really the test cases, the guinea pigs. You had talked about stereotypes or preconceptions. The guys that came in, and from my memory, it was all Yugoslavs or Soviets. It was Sharunas Marshalonis, Alexander Volkov, and Jarko Paspai were actually, I think, like the first group that came right after the Olympics. Shortly to follow were a few more famous ball players who made a more lasting impact and are known as the Trailblazers. But these guys were the first, so they were from the they were from those very countries that we had been introduced to as basketball powerhouses. And you know, clearly it's when Drazen Petrovic and Tony Kukoc come in, again, both from what we do as Yugoslavia, that really the shift, it's not a revolution yet, won't be for a little while, but that shift happens where we are seeing, it's not just curiosities. We are seeing players from other countries not only come in and make impacts and contribute to winning, but we are seeing players with skill sets that we haven't really seen from players at their size who are their American counterparts. So I think that's, you know, really what is the heart of it, is what ushers in what is to be not only a lasting change, but a total shift in the basketball landscape. My question is, that I will pose to you, is why do you think in 1988 to 90, it was the Yugoslavs and the Soviets who, as opposed to, for example, we had said pretty much the entire world is represented in the NBA. A country like Slovenia produces what might be the very, very best player. So truly, the entire landscape of possibility has changed. But in the past 20, 25 years, just to name four, France, Argentina, Spain, and Germany have not only produced several NBA players, but produced players at the very highest level while also competing for the top medals in international competition. Why, at the dawn of the 90s, were those countries, as well as almost every others, why was, do you think that was not a possibility for their pros, whereas it became a possibility for the athletes from the communist bloc?
The first would be decades of investment in hoops. in those countries. So they were far further along than the rest of the world. I mean, the USSR, you think of the massiveness of it, also had this population pool that was so dramatic that when it started to crack up and when players were able to, seek out their fortunes, I mean, that was where the bumper crop was going to be. We haven't talked yet about the 72 Olympics, where the Soviets won under profoundly sketchy circumstances, but that always stood as the one gold medal loss before 88 in Olympic history. And people always elide the fact with that game that the Soviet, I've watched that game, the Soviets thoroughly outplayed the US. The US was lucky to look like they were going to win. And yeah, the US should have won, but that also started a basketball boom in the Soviet Union where more and more people got into it. I mean, the guy who scored that winning basket, I think his name was Volkov, actually. He became like a freaking hero, like a national hero. And Yugoslavia, similarly, like a massive space with a history of hardcore state investment in it. And when it started breaking up, I think with the fall of the Soviet Union, then a place like Croatia, Slovenia, Serbia, they start developing their own shit and getting tons of investment, capital investment. To just build up in those spaces. So I just think it's a question of Soviet style state investment that then cracked into the free market, letting out all these incredible resources, extractivism, if you will, of this a kind of latent greatness that was being developed under our noses, but we were too arrogant as a country to scout it or notice until they busted through. And then when they busted through, didn't know what the fuck to do with them. I mean, your guy, Tony Kukoc, I mean, he would have thrived today in a way he couldn't thrive then because the basketball imagination was still too limited for a Tony Kukoc. And I'm glad, I'm happy to be a fan in times where I feel like, we're at a point where people at least see the possibilities of these players and their skill sets.
Certainly. I remember kind of learning about what was going on in a part of the world that I was not familiar with through basketball, and gaining consciousness through players coming into the NBA. We had talked about the US response to the advancing Soviet and Yugoslav basketball programs and the emphasis being placed on those programs. When these players that we're talking about, when they came into the NBA only 1 to 2 years later, Šarūnas Marčiulionis came in as a Lithuanian. Toni Kukoč and Dražen Petrović came in as Croats. Vlade Divac came in as a Serb. We had known those players as part of that incredible Yugoslavian basketball team. Marčiulionis was Sabonis' teammate on the Soviet team that had won the gold. So coming in just a year or two later, coming in under these new nationalities and proudly representing their nationalities, having become new republics, was an eye-opener. We were learning about the changes happening, major changes happening in the world because of labels being put players now identifying with a nationality or an ethnicity, a different one than they had been a few years earlier. We had talked about the preconceived notions or the stereotypes. These players were not welcomed with open arms. No. They were scorned. They weren't given a great deal of respect. We had talked briefly about Glauchkov being kind of that funny trivia question as to why he was the first, you know, and why somebody from Bulgaria. I'd like to learn more about that. But right, he was kind of the fact that he had flamed out quickly and hadn't made an impact was used as the, you know, that test case had failed. That's who these guys are. Remember, that was that one guy who came to Phoenix and didn't do anything and left? Yeah, that's how they fare in our league. Mm-hmm. Was the kind of overriding sentiment, it seemed, both by fans and certainly by coaching staffs, mm-hmm. and maybe even front offices. So these guys really had to, they really had to earn it. Mm-hmm. And almost all of these players began their careers out of their team's rotations. And a few of them never broke through. I had mentioned Volkov and Paspai. I remember those guys only because they were the pioneers. But they never made an impact and only lasted in the league for a short time, both of them. Marshalonis, Divat, Petrovic, and in my mind, the greatest of all of them, Kukoc, really had to take their lumps and fight a lot of stereotypes. There were stereotypes that not only was there a language barrier, but these players just weren't intelligent enough to really think the game on this level. There was a stereotype that these guys weren't athletic enough to compete with the American players. There was a stereotype that they weren't tough enough to compete with the American players. And each of these guys came in and with their own unique games, player by player, broke down these stereotypes and kind of proved too good to sit, too good to snub. And not only that, but in the case of the three Yugoslavian pioneers, really bringing an aspect to the game and thus an aspect to the NBA that not only was unique, but very much resembles the way players play today and are taught to play today. Vlade was 7'1" and could handle and really pass in almost that Sabonis mode. He was a playmaker.
Mm-hmm.
While definitely being 7'1" on defense, he was a playmaker, ushering in the sense that a big man could do things besides just park himself on the block.
Kukoc being a 6'11" wing, I mean, who could obviously play all three stages of the court, all three levels, a three-level score. They didn't know what to do with him. But these guys, and I agree with you completely about Divac, like what's expected of a center now. I mean, there's a blueprint when Vlade was really doing it by himself.
He was the only one.
He's the only one. Like it's good to have a center who can pass the shit out of the ball. That's an advantage, you know?
Yeah.
I just think it's fascinating to walk through that. And then, but the softness thing stuck around. And even recently, we talked about this on a previous show. Gilbert Arenas said that today European players are too soft. And it just makes me like, do you even watch the games? I mean, Nikola Jokic will quite literally consume you for, as a snack, as an aperitif, Gilbert. It's like too soft. Are you kidding me? These guys are burly as hell. Now, but you take it back to this time, it's like, oh, finesse players, finesse players. And I just want to say one quick thing about that. The first was that Drazen Petrovic was in no way a finesse player. He tough as nails. But his death, of course, people forget, he made All NBA the year that he died. I mean, third team All NBA. So that's incredible. None of his countrymen ever did that. And he was just poised for such greatness, and he would have killed every stereotype through his mighty fists. But the other one that we need to mention in all of this is Pau Gasol, even though a few years later, but like playing with a tougher style than people were used to seeing, and then Marc Gasol, his brother, the same. I mean, Gilbert Arenas aside, that to me was the big break with the old stereotype when the Gasol brothers started knocking people around.
And that is, the Gasols are really, we're talking the middle of the first decade of the 21st century. So in that case, it took a while. As the league is becoming more populated with non-American born players, and as it's growing from these countries in Eastern Europe into not only the rest of Europe, but all different continents. The international pool in the NBA continuing to grow every year. The stereotypes are kind of breaking down as the numbers are growing. And we had said Sabonis arrives in the middle of the 90s, finally with Portland. And while he's no longer the guy, running the fast break, going behind the back and finishing with a reverse dunk, still, as you said, still, clearly an impact player in the NBA, then going into players like Tony Parker, guard becoming the point guard on a multi-time champion, and then his backcourt mate from South America, Ginobili. So the 90s are really the beginning of the 90s is when the pioneers arrive. That first decade is numbers are growing, except stereotypes are still holding strong. And there's still somewhat of a complete of a reluctance to completely embrace these players and what they can bring. And it's really, you had mentioned the Gasols, who are a big part of this, and Spain becomes an absolute basketball powerhouse on the world stage, producing many great pros, both in the NBA and throughout the EuroLeague.
The
Parker and
legacy of
Ginobili,
Barcelona,
Park,
92.
right? Absolutely. Parker and Ginobili, big ones. To me, even more than Pau, and I know you were specifically talking about finally knocking down the pesky softness moniker, finally putting that to rest. But Dirk Nowitzki, I think, is as important as anybody else, or maybe the most important international player since that first class. at the beginning of the 90s, those the trendsetters. Dirk comes in from Germany at 18 or 19, looking very much 18. Looks overwhelmed in his first NBA season, as most 19-year-olds from anywhere do. And what Dirk's career became, I think that Dirk winning MVPs, winning championships, taking down that Heat team after taking down, after ending the Lakers' hopes of a second three-peat, Dirk ascending to the top of the league and staying there, I think is what finally changes the narrative. Yao Ming is another huge person, but another huge figure in all of this. But Dirk, I think, because when he was winning MVPs, the naysayers were still saying, yeah, but he can't lead you to a championship.
Too soft. Even and then, averaging 10 boards a game.
And then he led them to a championship, and there were still excuses as to why it happened. But Dirk finishes his career at something like the seventh or eighth all-time leading scorer.
With the longest NBA career with one team in NBA history.
So I think that looking at a league, one thing I really like and that I was thinking of when you kicked this conversation off is I completely agree with you. If I had to, off the top of my head, say who I think the four best players or the four MVPs of the NBA are, I'd say in no particular order, Jokic, Doncic, Antetokounmpo, and Embiid. And those guys have won the last five or six MVPs.
Yeah, in
truth. So it isn't just personal preference. These are the guys at the top of the league. I think that if a lot of people would be surprised at that, and not even fascinated. Again, the nice thing is at this point, that's not even a big deal.
Right.
That is not such a huge deal. It is so normalized, as it should be. The NBA is the league of the greatest players in the world, coming from all backgrounds, all educational lengths of educational athletic careers, all different kinds. It is truly opened up in the way that it should.
And make U.S. players better.
So, you know, being it certainly should be vindication for the Kukoc's and Marshallonis's and Petrovic's, which kind of had to weather all of that. And, you know, and were so kind of unfairly labeled, I think, even after they had proven what excellent players they were. The fact that it's really no big deal. It's almost trivia that those four guys aren't American. I think that is kind of the greatest legacy and the greatest mark of success for that first batch of guys that endured and showed that you could succeed, so that not only their countrymen, but great French players, Argentinian players, Spanish players, and all of the other countries that I haven't mentioned, which have great players, and players who have had great careers in, or having great careers in the NBA, passing that along to the Nowitzkis and the Gasols and Parkers and Yao, going into where we are now. Is is a true success story and really is the companion narrative to when we talked recently about the state of the NBA today. They are absolutely intertwined.
It's a good note to end on. Shiraz, well summed up. If there's any, all right, name the first image that comes to your head if I say a play made by a player who's in the category of didn't go to high school or college in the US, came here and kicked butt. What's the first image that comes to your head? What play? I could give you mine first if you're still.
What play? What single play?
Yeah, like what's the first play that comes to your mind? I just did it myself. It was fun.
Phil Jackson correctly calling a play for Kukoc and not bitch ass Scottie Pippen to hit a game winner in the playoffs at Madison Square Garden to beat the Knicks in Kukoc's rookie year.
Wow. My image is of being with you and your amazing son, Diego, and seeing for the only time in my life, Dirk Nowitzki live, and seeing how high the ball would go up when he would shoot, which might be higher than I can even throw a ball with the shooting motion. That was his shot. That's what I'll remember.
Dirk had a famously, of course, but ridiculously high release on that unbelievably sweet jumper. And I have tried to duplicate his shot, and not only don't mine go in, but that takes a lot of arm strength.
It's a lot of arm strength
to shoot that way. It's a great memory. I remember being at Barclays for that Mavs game, and it was a. There are so many great players over the generations of my fandom that I've never seen live. Most of the great players I've never seen live, as opposed to having seen live, I think. But it was a huge treat to see Dirk, even in his last 5 years. It was seeing one of the great players of all time.
Abso-frickin-tutely. And we'll go down as the, I think he will go down eventually as the last sole superstar championship team.
Yeah, I mean,
I guess it's all about what you think of Jamal Murray.
Yes, that's very, it's what you think about Jamal Murray.
Because there is no Jamal Murray equivalent on those Mavs teams.
No, there isn't. Jamal was better than whoever the next best player on. Yeah, that's a one-man team.
Yeah.
Denver, it's a gray area.
It's a gray area. We'll leave it to the listeners to weigh in on that one. Hey, thank you, everybody. Thank you, Shiraz. Thanks all y'all who've been listening. This one was a particularly amazing one, so don't only like it. Don't only send me a little email. Also tell your friends and pass it around. That's how we break through the noise and people can hear discussions just like this. Big thank you to The Nation Magazine. Thank you to everybody out there listening. For Ari Shirazi, I'm Dave Zirin. We are out of here. Peace.